This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. Meghna Chakrabarty is away today. Chicken and dumplings, cheese, woodchucks, succotash, Marlboro pie. Sounds like a great feast from a turn-of-the-century New England kitchen. In fact, these are just some of the dishes that appear in a new cookbook from Yankee Magazine lifestyle editor Amy Traverso. The book is called Lost in Vintage Recipes. It's a collection, and I'm actually eating a brownie from the collection, I have to admit. I didn't quite get it done before I started reading this copy in front of me. But this is a collection of recipes buried deep in Yankee Magazine's archive that were worthy of revival. And not only do they taste delicious, they also tell us stories about our own culinary history. Amy Traverso joins us in the studio now to share some of the highlights from Lost in Vintage Recipes. And Amy, thanks for coming back. It's good to see you back at Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me.
So tell us about the genesis of this book. What prompted you to put it together?
I spend some of my spare time when I'm in Yankee's offices up in New Hampshire in the conference room where we have all the old leather-bound editions of Yankee that date back to 1935. And I just love flipping through the books because there's this element of, you know, history come to life or history filtered into daily life. There's old ads for, you know, wicker basket to transport your pies to the church picnic. You know, all those little details of life back then. So, and I started to notice as I was looking through them that there are recipes that sounded really compelling, but that had completely fallen off the radar. And, you know, our appetites get bored. They need variety. And so we kind of leave things behind, but then we kind of forget that they're really good things that we're leaving behind.
Well, I want to talk about some of these recipes in particular, but in your introduction to the book, you talk about how recipes don't just tell us how to make a dish, they tell us stories about how people live. What did you learn about sort of the past way of life and about culinary history while putting this book together?
Well, certainly when I got down to the nitty-gritty of editing and testing the recipes, I realized how much more home cooks used to know about cooking. Recipes were much, more general. They weren't very specific. You could sort of assume your reader knew things. So the recipes would say something like, you know, make a pastry as for pie.
Oh, yeah, that's easy.
Fill with a chicken that has been poached with carrots and onion as for soup. I mean, you know, we could never do that now. So I certainly realize how much we no longer learn how to cook growing up, and we need that instruction in recipes. There were some just strange little things. I learned that fondue should be, you know, every home host or hostess should know how to make fondue and have a fondue party. I rediscovered that. There are ingredients that have fallen out of favor that are so good, like making sauces.
See, I'm surprised to hear that there's a fondue recipe buried in the archives of sort of lost and vintage recipes
well,
at
vintage
Yankee.
Well, vintage 1960s, you know, fondue sort of had its heyday in the 60s and 70s.
Yeah.
We really allowed for any recipe that captured our imaginations, that felt like it connected us to our own memories or some sort of longer history. There were ingredients like sherry, vermouth, and Madeira used to be in sauces all the time, and they fell out of favor, but they're delicious. We cook with wine now, but we don't really cook as often with sherry and Madeira, and people think it's dated, but it's actually really delicious and rich.
Well, let me ask you about a couple of recipes that jumped out at me. First of all, you've brought two delicious dessert dishes here, but we'll talk about those. I think we should do the main course first.
Yes.
Here's one, cheese woodchuck, which is a variation on Welsh rarebit.
Yes.
What's the story behind this dish?
So this is a perfect illustration of how a lot of the stories of where recipes come from tend to be apocryphal. I think there are usually two potential sources. In this case, there are two very interesting sources. We ran a story in 1966. It was a reader named Mildred B. Larrabee wrote in to tell us about the story of an ill-fated ship from Amsterdam that foundered off the coast of Portland and offloaded a lot of cheese, a lot of Dutch cheese. The cheese floated over to Peaks Island. The women of Peaks Island collected all this cheese, and they had to become very innovative about how to use it because everybody was getting really sick of eating cheese. So they came up with this dish, cheese woodchuck, which is essentially sort of a custardy cheese sauce with corn and herbs in it, and you sort of serve it with crusty bread, and it's delicious. It's almost like a cross between Welsh rarebit and fondue. There is another dish from the 30s that's called woodchuck. It uses canned tomato soup and cheese, and you sort of make a creamy sauce. I like the main version, though, myself.
It sounds great. So there's so many more in here that we're not going to have time to talk about, but I'm just going to just give a sort of sample here. Deviled eggs, which I love. A rustic potato and broccoli soup. I'd like to know more about that. There's old standards like corn chowder. What's better than that? succotash, which I want to ask you about. But this one sounds like it has a real Boston connection. Harvard Beets. Tell us about this recipe.
So some people may remember eating really bad versions of Harvard Beets growing up, but it actually is a really tasty dish if you do it well. And everybody loves pickled things now. Pickles are very hot. This is sort of pickled beets. So there are, again, two possible versions of the store or of the history of the name. Could just be that the beets are the same color as the Harvard jersey. Very simple. Or there's another story, which is really charming. It talks about a Russian emigre who opened up a tavern, a restaurant, in 1846 in Boston. And he, the name of the tavern was Harwood's. But this man, being Russian, pronounced it like Harwood. And so the name became Harwood Beets, and it then morphed into Harvard Beets. Probably.
So it's got nothing to do with the crimson and all that.
Probably more likely, it probably was a dish served at Harvard and was named after the crimson, I think.
That's great. Well, listen, you've put in front of us here two beautiful, sweet treats here. Tell us what we're looking at.
Okay, so one of the...
And I've tasted them both, and I'm not going to subject the listeners to me sort of slurping away. I'm going to say they're both delicious, but just tell us
what they are. Okay, so my favorite discovery working on this book was the waffle iron brownie. I mean, it's so smart because people love the crunchy outsides of brownies.
Yes.
These are all crunchy outsides with like a chewy interior. It's a recipe that appeared in a 1953 issue of Yankee. I saw it, my eyes lit up. I said, I've got to make this. I went home and made it. It was horrible. It was really, really bad. It was sort of a cakey batter. It wasn't good. So I calibrated it to modern brownie tastes. And they're so much fun. They take about 6 minutes to cook. The whole thing takes a half an hour. Kids love this because, you know, it's the cooking is happening right in front of them on the counter.
It's a great idea. They're delicious. And what I like about it is I have a waffle iron that comes out of the cupboard maybe, I don't know, once a year or something.
Exactly.
So here's something else to do
exactly.
with a waffle iron.
Yes, yes, multi-purpose.
And this is?
Okay, blueberry boy bait. This is a very sweet.
That's blueberry boy bait.
Blueberry boy bait. And it is, as it sounds, a dish that's designed to attract boys. This was a recipe from a 15-year-old girl who in 1954 submitted it to the Pillsbury $100,000 Recipe and Baking Contest. This is the precursor to the Pillsbury Bake Off. She took second place for this cake, which she named after its ability to lure boys, but it really lived on. I don't even know what the winner was that year. This is the one that really kind of stuck around, and it's one of the most popular recipes we have on our website.
Well, it's delicious. It's sort of it's really a cake.
Yeah.
It's a cake that's just laced with a topping of blueberries that have sort of melted in and sort of fused with this whole delicious kind of pound cake-like?
It's sort of a coffee/pound cake. It's very easy to make. It's an oil cake, which means you just, you know, throw everything together and mix it, and then you put the blueberries on top. They sink in. You sprinkle a little cinnamon sugar on top, and there you go.
These remind me of recipes. I mean, they are. You label them vintage recipes that were lost, but they really do evoke another time. Do they remind you of, I don't know, of things that you might have had in your childhood long time ago?
Yeah, I mean, I think half the reason I was so excited about doing this book is because I felt it made me feel so connected to the foods I grew up with, and I was just filled with these great memories of eating my grandmother's food and my mom's food. I mean, chicken cacciatore, chicken a la king, turkey tetrazzini, so good, and such a great way to use leftover Thanksgiving turkey. I definitely adapted these recipes. I altered them. The sauces weren't too gloopy or heavy. Tried to kind of give them a little bit more of a fresh, modern feel. But they very much are the recipes. They will taste familiar to you if you try them. And I think, you know, in our culture, food is sort of a connector. We are attracted to food because it makes us feel that connection.
This seems like a book of recipe for comfort food. Comfort
yes.
recipes, I think, is a big way. I'm curious to know if there were recipes that didn't make the cut, ones that were just wouldn't work today. We're just too weird.
Well, how about, would you like to have some deviled egg casserole? Because we had a recipe for that and it didn't make the book. We had jellied bean salad. There were a lot of things in aspic that were just so unappetizing that I couldn't. They never even got to the testing phase.
That's great. Now, what about health? I mean, there's a lot of concern about food that is healthy, not too fattening. Where does this stand in sort of the hierarchy of health food?
Right. Well, I would say that, you know, certainly our mothers and grandmothers were cooking chicken a la king and turkey tetrazzini and scallops with butter, and there was no national obesity epidemic at the time. I think I would argue that, of course, as Julia Child said, everything in moderation, including moderation. I think that that all these foods are perfectly good to eat, and they are made with fresh ingredients, not processed ingredients. So when you're making a dish that's full of fresh vegetables and good meat, and it has a little bit of a creamy sauce, but nothing outrageous, I feel very good about serving that to my family.
Well, I think as we go off onto this long Memorial Day weekend, thinking of a quote from Julia Child, everything in moderation, including moderation, what could be better? I think that's a great idea to end this segment on. Amy Traverso, thanks so much for coming in. We really appreciate
it. This was fun. Thanks.
So that's Amy Traverso. She's the food and lifestyle editor at Yankee Magazine. The new book is Lost and Vintage Recipes, and you can go to RadioBoston.org to read more about it. And that's our program for the day and for this week. Radio Boston is a production of WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Anthony Brooks. Join us again Monday on Memorial Day for more Radio Boston.